As we know, there is more than one context when we're discussing prophecy. One context is the context which applies to those Jews living at the time that the prophecy was given. This might be considered a historical context or perhaps a real-time context. In other words, what did the people who actually heard or read these prophecies make of them, and how did they interpret them? Now, the second context of prophecy is what it means to Christians living many hundreds of years after the prophecy was given. Usually, these are referred to as end-time prophecies. Because we are living, we think, in the end times, we usually focus the vast majority of our attention on the end-time aspect of prophecy. But seeing as though the panel discussion will be covering the principle of how these verses relate to us in the end times, instead of taking the end times view of Ezekiel's prophecies, I've chosen to take mostly a historical view. In doing this, I hope to lay a better foundation for understanding the historical context of Ezekiel's book, and to come away with a better appreciation of God's prophetic word as it applied to his typical people at the time that it was given. We'll begin with the observation that the book of Ezekiel is probably one of the most difficult books of the Bible. Because of this, it is probably one of the most neglected books of the Bible. Thankfully for us, some of the difficulty of this book is to some extent offset by its orderly arrangement. And here you could refer to part A of your handout. I prefer to divide the book into four main sections as follows. Section 1 includes chapters 1 through 24. In it are prophecies about the doom of Jerusalem and Judah. These were delivered before the fall of the city and the state in 606 BC. Section 2 includes chapters 25 through 32. In it are prophecies concerning the judgment and fall of foreign nations. Section 3 includes chapters 33 through 39. In it are prophecies of restoration and hope for the nation of Israel. And section 4 includes chapters 40 through 48. In it are prophecies about the new temple and the restored community. Well, our assignment is to address Ezekiel 3:17. In order to look specifically at what it means that Ezekiel was to appoint a watchman, give warning to the house of Israel concerning the doom of Jerusalem and Judah, we'll have to look into the historical background surrounding Ezekiel's ministry. Now, we need to do this not in order to understand every detail of ancient Hebrew history, but to get a clearer picture of Ezekiel's ministry. So it will be very general and oversimplified. So this is the Reader's Digest version, if you will, of the historical background of Ezekiel's prophecy. And here you could refer to part B on your outline. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, deported Judah into exile in two stages. The first, about 617 BC, and the second, 11 years later in 606 BC. The first exile was due to the foreign policy of King Jehoiakim, who was king of Judah. After accepting the sovereignty of Babylon for 3 years, Jehoiakim rebelled. he himself did not live to face the consequences of his rebellion, but his son, Jehoiachin, who had reigned only 3 months when the armies of Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city, and he was forced to surrender. Jehoiachin was deported to Babylon, along with a large number of Judah's leaders and influential citizens, including Ezekiel. Now, in place of Jehoiachin, his uncle, Zedekiah, was placed on the throne of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar. After about 8 years, Zedekiah broke into of allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar, and with the support of Egypt, he revolted against Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar attacked Judah and then besieged Jerusalem. For 2.5 terrible years, the siege dragged on until in 606 BC the city fell. Zedekiah was taken prisoner, his eyes were put out, and his sons were killed in his presence. The city of Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed, and a second deportation took place. Ezekiel prophesied between the first and second deportations, and he also prophesied after the second deportation. Chapters 1 through 24 were given between the first and second deportation, and most of the last 24 chapters were given after the second deportation. Well, let's take a minute now to consider what little we know about the personal life of Ezekiel. We know that he was a priest, and that the Babylonians must have considered him a person of some importance because they included him among the cream of the population taken in the first exile. We know that he was married, and that he and his wife settled in Babylon with their fellow exiles at a place called Tel Abib on the river Chebar. And there they lived in a house of their own. We know also that Ezekiel was a man of great strength of will and purpose. His character is well defined by God in chapter 3 and verses 8 through 9 at the very beginning of his ministry. God addresses Ezekiel there with these words: "Like adamant, harder than flint, have I made your forehead." Ezekiel was stronger than the rebellious house. He was more resolute than the obstinate and disobedient people. In other words, Ezekiel was a hard-headed man. But he was hard-headed for the things of the Lord. About his first 4 years in Babylon, nothing is known. But in the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiachin, according to chapter 1 and verse 2 of Ezekiel, he received his call and commission to be a prophet of God, and his whole ministry lasted for about 22 years. Turn with me now to chapter 1, and we're going to read verses 1 and 2 of Ezekiel. Chapter 1, 1 and 2 reads: "Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the 4th month, in the 5th day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Chebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. And the Spirit entered into me, and he spake unto me, and set me upon my feet, that I heard him that spake unto me." When Ezekiel had been in exile for about 5 years, he received his call to the prophetic ministry. That ministry was preceded by a vision of the chariot throne of God, which Ezekiel saw at the river Chebar, which is a river, or perhaps a canal, in the land of the Chaldeans, where Ezekiel and the others of the first captivity lived. Now, without reading it, the friends, I hope, are somewhat familiar with this vision of the chariot throne of God. What Ezekiel saw in chapter 1 in his vision was a bright storm cloud approaching from the north. And out of this cloud, lightning was flashing forth continually. In this cloud, Ezekiel was able to discern four living creatures, each one having four wings and four faces, a man, a lion, an ox, and an eagle. Alongside these four winged living creatures were four huge wheels. The rims of these wheels were full of eyes roundabout. Now, these wheels were attached to a platform in such a way that the platform could move in any direction, not just forward and backwards. Both the creatures and the wheels supported a solid platform shining like crystal, upon which sat a throne. A majestic figure of indescribable brightness and splendor, representing God, was seated on the throne. Overwhelmed by the majesty and glory of God, Ezekiel prostrated himself to the ground, only to be set on his feet by the power and Spirit of God in the first verse of chapter 2. In an outstretched hand, Ezekiel saw a roll of a book on both sides of which were written words of lamentation and mourning and woe. Chapter 2 and the first three verses of chapter 3 tells us how Ezekiel was commanded to eat the roll and to proclaim the words of judgment written thereon to the house of Israel. And now you could refer to part C on your outline. Without going into detail about the possible symbolic meanings of Ezekiel's vision, of which there are many, I want to briefly touch on three things relevant or revealed by the vision that were very relevant to Ezekiel and to those Israelites who heard or read his writings. The first is that the throne of God is not fixed and in one place. It was of vital importance to those Hebrews exiled in Babylon that they should realize that the living God was not confined to the Promised Land or to the Holy of Holies in the Jerusalem Temple. By means of these symbols, it was revealed that God was mobile, and that he could be and he would be with his people even in captivity in a foreign land. The second is that Ezekiel was aware that what he saw was a vision from God. He understood that it was given to him in symbol, in picture language, and that it only represented the true reality. Ezekiel didn't really think that God actually rides through the heavens on a throne supported by four-headed creatures. This is why he took great care and why he uses the terms likeness and appearance when attempting to describe God. Ezekiel's vision reminds us that even when God reveals himself to us, he still remains far beyond our understanding. For now, we see only in a mirror dimly the overwhelming majesty and mystery of God. Now, the third thing revealed by the vision is that the words of God communicated to the prophet are specifically seen by him as written on a roll of a book. About 30 years earlier than this, in the 18th year of King Josiah's reign, after being lost for a number of years, the discovery of the written law in the temple had resulted in a reformation of worship and life. What they found in the temple was most likely the book of Deuteronomy, or at least the central portion of the book, which led to the steadily increasing importance of the written word in the life of Israel, and even more now, since they had gone into captivity and the temple had been destroyed. They were to become the people of the book. This is symbolized by the roll of a book which the prophet is ordered to eat. Now, the practical lesson for us is that God's message gives profound inner joy, and especially to those messengers who are able to receive it and then to deliver it. The roll was in the messenger's mouth as sweet as honey. But it's important to keep in mind that this inner satisfaction does not depend on outward circumstances. Ezekiel was warned not to expect success. In fact, he was warned to expect the opposite. God told Ezekiel that the house of Israel will not listen to you because they're not willing to listen to me. But the message must be delivered, whether the people accept it or reject it. So we learn a lesson that the messenger is not ordered to be successful, but he is ordered to be faithful in receiving and then delivering the message. Well, we want to pick up the account now in Ezekiel chapter 3, and we want to read verses 10 through 15. Ezekiel 3, verses 10 through 15, which reads, "Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, all my words that I shall speak unto thee, receive in thine heart, and hear with thine ears. And go, get thee to them of the captivity, unto the children of thy people, and speak unto them, and tell them, thus saith the Lord, whether they will hear, or whether they will forbear. Then the Spirit took me up, and I heard behind me a voice of a great rushing, saying, Blessed be the glory of the Lord from this place. I heard also the noise of the wings of living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and the noise of a great rushing. So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness, in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of the Lord was strong upon me. Then I came to them of the captivity at Tel Aviv, that dwelt by the river Chebar. And I sat where they were, and remained there, astonished among them, 7 days. You might now refer to section D on your outline. Ezekiel is told to go, get thee to them of the captivity. But this raises something of a question. We're told in chapter 1 that Ezekiel was already with the exiles on the river Chebar. So why, in chapter 3 and verse 15, was he lifted away by the Spirit to be with them of the captivity at Tel Aviv by the river Chebar? This can be kind of confusing. Were these two different places on the river Chebar, or were they the same place? Two possible explanations might help clarify this question as to what is going on. The first possibility is that after Ezekiel saw the vision of the chariot throne of God in chapter 1, he was then taken away from that place of captivity that he shared with the exiles of Judah on the banks of the river Chebar, and he was transported to a second place where a different group of exiles were living by the river Chebar, but at a place called Tel Abib. The second explanation is that both chapter 1 and chapter 3 are referring to the exact same place. In chapter 1, when Ezekiel sees the vision and receives the call to the prophetic ministry, he is not in the settlement proper and among his fellow captives. Instead, he is alone and outside the settlement, in the wilderness, if you will. After receiving the vision and calling in the wilderness, Ezekiel returns to the community at Tel Abib to prophesy in chapter 3. In other words, he was living among the people for about 4 years as nothing more than an average person. Then he goes into the wilderness and receives visions, and when he returns to the same people he'd been living with for those 4 years, he is now a prophet. This is something like how Jesus was living among the people for 30 years before he went into the wilderness for 40 days to receive his call, and afterward he returned to preach. So too with Ezekiel. Now, whichever explanation appeals to you, it doesn't alter the fact that Ezekiel was to deliver a hard message concerning the doom of the city and the destruction of the temple. And his message was intended for two distinct groups. It was for those already in exile in Babylon who were in danger of being deluded by false hopes of a speedy return to the homeland. And it was for those still in Judah who would soon experience the terrible consequences of Ezekiel's warning of doom. You might refer now to part E on your outline. The downfall of the city and state, which is the main theme of this part of Ezekiel's prophecy, is depicted in a number of symbolic acts after Ezekiel is told to give the warning in chapter 3 and verse 17. For instance, in chapter 4 and verses 1 through 3, Ezekiel was commanded by God to take a brick or a slab of clay and to outline the city of Jerusalem on it, and then to act out the part of the Babylonians by pressing a siege against this brick or this tile. By doing this, Ezekiel was enacting God's intention to overthrow the city. In chapter 4, in verses 4 through 17, Ezekiel was directed to lie on his side for 430 days, first on his left side for 390 days, and then on his right side for 40 days. Ezekiel was then commanded to prepare cheap and coarse bread, and he was told to bake it by using human dung, which was an unclean fuel. He was to eat his crummy portion of bread and drink a little water each day for the 430 days that he was lying on his side. This represented that severe food shortages would be imposed during the siege, and that in the exile, they would have to eat their bread in an unclean land. In Ezekiel 5, and verses 1 and 2, Ezekiel was instructed to cut off the hair of his head and his beard, and to divide it into three parts. One part was to be burned, a second part was struck with a sword, and a third part was scattered to the winds. In these acts, Ezekiel symbolically depicted the fate of the people of Jerusalem. The burnt hair represents some would die of disease and famine. The hair struck with a sword represents some would be slain. And the hair scattered in the wind represents some would be scattered in exile. In chapter 12, and verses 1 through 16, shortly before the downfall of the city, Ezekiel received the order from God to prepare for yourself an exile's baggage. He was then to dig a hole through the wall of his house at night and pass through this hole, carrying his few salvaged belongings on his back. In this act, he symbolized two things. One was the going forth of the people into exile, and the other was King Zedekiah's attempt to escape by night from that doomed city. In chapter 24, and verses 15 to 27, on the very day the siege of Jerusalem began, Ezekiel's wife suddenly and unexpectedly died in the evening in their home at Tel Aviv. Now, it was customary for people of the Middle East then, even as it is today, to express tremendous outward expression to their inner emotion at the death of a loved one. But although Ezekiel was no doubt deeply devoted to his wife, he was ordered to suppress his grief, to give no traditional signs of outward mourning. As intended by God, this unusual and extraordinary conduct attracted the attention of the other captives. And this too was meant for a symbol and a sign to the people that at the fall of Jerusalem, the grief of the captives would be too deep for cries and tears. They would instead be stunned into silence by the overwhelming catastrophe. You might refer now to point F on your outline. Now, as part of his warning, Ezekiel does not only act out, the doom of Jerusalem. He also uses allegories to tell the tragic story of the people of God. For instance, all 8 verses of chapter 15 is the allegory of the vine. Among all the trees of the forest, the wild vine is worthless. Its wood cannot be used for anything useful. Not even a little peg can be made out of it to hang something. Jerusalem has become lifeless, worthless, useless, fit only for the fire of destruction. In John 15, recall how Jesus contrasted himself and his disciples with this symbol of faithless Israel when he said, "I am the true vine, and you are the branches." In Ezekiel chapter 16, in a very long historical allegory, Jerusalem is likened to a girl of mixed parentage who is exposed and left to die after birth. But God pitied and rescued her, and she grew up, and she became tall and arrived at full maidenhood. Then God took her to be his wife. And he treated her royally, dressed her in beautiful clothes and in costly jewelry. But she was disloyal to her husband, and she played the harlot, offering herself to every passerby. But these same lovers she went whoring after would bring about her humiliation and downfall. Even so, God would not abandon her, but in loyal love, he would restore and establish her. In chapter 23, Ezekiel tells a similar allegory of two unchaste sisters, Ahola, who represents Samaria, and Aholibah, who represents Jerusalem. They were both espoused to God, and both were unfaithful to him. Samaria, the capital of the 10-tribe northern kingdom, was the first to be destroyed by her lovers, the Assyrians. But her fate has been ignored by her sister, Jerusalem, the capital of Judah, who has now turned from the Babylonians to the Egyptians, as Zedekiah has abandoned the oath of allegiance to Babylon, and he turned to Egypt for protection. But Jerusalem, like Samaria before her, will suffer destruction at the hands of the lover who is forsaking her. Now, in both of these allegories, the idolatrous worship adopted by Israel and Judah from Assyria, Egypt, and Babylon is spoken of under the figure of unchastity. The marriage analogy is used to set forth the relationship between God and Israel. The Apostle Paul used it of the relationship between Christ and the church. It is supposed to be a relationship of loyal love. But Ezekiel points out the glaring contrast between God's compassion and faithfulness with the people's ingratitude and disloyalty. We're on part G now of your outline, if you'd like to take a look here. We're going to look now at what was going on with the people of Judah that required such a dire warning about the destruction of the city and the temple. What was the state of affairs in Judah under King Zedekiah after the first deportation and before the fall of Jerusalem 11 years later? The sad fact is that the Reformation under Josiah was forgotten, and idolatry was rampant in the land, and even within the precincts of the temple. In chapter 8, verses 5 through 16, Ezekiel is shown four separate acts of idol worship within the temple precincts. How exactly he could see from Babylon what was going on in Jerusalem, we're not told, other than that he was transported by the Spirit. Now in verses 5 and 6 of chapter 8, he was shown near the north gate an image or an idol of some sort that provoked the jealousy of God. In verses 7 through 13 of chapter 8, he was shown that on the walls of one of the rooms of the gateway were carved figures of reptiles and animals, before which 70 elders were secretly burning incense. This form of animal worship was perhaps a holdover from Egypt, where animal worship of all kinds was extremely popular. In verses 14 and 15 of chapter 8,
Ezekiel was shown near the northern gate women weeping for the god Tammuz. And in verses 16 through 18, Ezekiel saw 25 men standing between the temple and the altar, with their backs turned disrespectfully to the Holy of Holies. These 25 men had their faces turned to the east, and they were worshiping the sun. After all these things shown to Ezekiel, all of these things, they were typical examples of what was happening all over the land of Israel. The people had lost their love and the desire to worship and to obey the living God of Israel. As we see from Ezekiel's visions, idol worship was rampant, and it surely led to other sins, which are also brought out by Ezekiel. For instance, in chapter 22, in verses 1 to 12, the list of the sins of Judah, and especially sins against the most vulnerable members of society, are enumerated. From these verses, it seems that so many had been put to death by the wicked rulers that Ezekiel described Jerusalem as the city of blood. Among the sins of the people, Ezekiel specifies contempt for parents, the ruthless oppression of the fatherless, the widow, and the sojourner, lying, sexual immorality of many kinds. These are among the many evils denounced by God in Ezekiel's visions. Not only were the rulers and the people denounced, so are the prophets. These are probably the prophets of the royal court. In verses 1 through 16 of chapter 13, Ezekiel says of the prophets that while they are claiming to speak the word of God, they prophesy out of their own minds and follow their own spirit, being blind to the sorry state of the nation and unaware of the coming judgment. They are like men who hid the flaws and weaknesses in a mud brick wall by smearing it over with whited plaster. Being self-deceived, they misled the people by encouraging a false optimism by saying, "Peace, peace," when there is no peace. We're now on part H of the outline. So, we see that for the people, the prophets, and the rulers, Ezekiel has, at this portion of his ministry, where he is commissioned to give warning about the coming destruction, not a single word of hope. He says in chapter 21, in verses 1 to 5, "The sword of the Lord is about to be drawn." This sword is, in verses 18 to 23 of chapter 1, depicted as the king of Babylon standing at the fork of the road, casting lots to decide whether Jerusalem or Ammon is to be crushed first. Nebuchadnezzar decides to take the road to Jerusalem first. In verses 24 to 27 of chapter 21, Nebuchadnezzar destroys the city and punishes King Zedekiah, who had broken his oath of allegiance to Babylon. God's righteous judgment is carried out on the people and the city with these words: "A ruin, a ruin, a ruin will I make it. This shall be no more. There will not be even a trace of it until he who comes, whose right it is, and to him, the ideal king, who we know is Jesus, will I give it." Well, so far we've mostly considered Ezekiel's prophecies and teachings in chapters 1 to 24. These related to the situation in Jerusalem between the first deportation and the fall of the city 11 years later in 606 BC. We now want to look at Ezekiel's message in the second half of his book, which were intended for the Jews in exile after the fall of Jerusalem. Now, according to Jeremiah, in chapter 29, verses 4 through 7, the captives were treated fairly leniently, and they had quite a bit of freedom. They were allowed to marry, to build houses of their own, to plant gardens, and to engage in business. But they were still, for the most part, discouraged and dispirited at the loss of Jerusalem and the temple. Ezekiel reports them as saying, in chapter 37 and verse 11, "Our bones are dried up, and our hope is lost. We are clean cut off." Before the fall of Jerusalem, Ezekiel was the prophet of bitterness. But after the fall, he becomes the prophet of restoration and hope. Now you might consider part I of your outline. In the second half of his book, Ezekiel describes the establishment of the new Israel, which features the renewal of true worship and the transformation of the land. But would any of this peace and prosperity Ezekiel prophesies about be even remotely possible if the existence of Israel is still continually threatened by powerful enemies right there on the borders? Well, the answer, of course, is no. To say to the people, "Go back to your land and live in peace and prosperity," without addressing the security of its borders, would be an unreasonable expectation. And that is why, in chapters 25 through 32, the downfall of the surrounding pagan nations, who were Israel's traditional enemies, is described in a series of oracles or words of the Lord. These assurances of security came to Ezekiel after the destruction of the old Israel and before the establishment of the new Israel. Israel is promised that after gloating over the fall of Jerusalem, these nations would not be spared the punishment which had befallen God's people. Three countries on Israel's eastern frontier, Ammon, Moab, and Edom, and Philistia to her southwest, who had all been vindictive and malice and malicious in their rejoicing and their taking advantage of the downfall of Judea, they are all doomed to destruction in chapter 25. In chapters 26 through 28, there are several oracles against Tyre, the capital of Phoenicia, which was built on an island off the coast and considered impregnable. It was particularly the Phoenicians who were sea traders. And Tyre, which was its chief city, is especially targeted by Ezekiel. Tyre, likened to a great seagoing ship made rich by the sea, is depicted as floundering and then being destroyed by the sea. Yet, that is, Tyre was captured by Nebuchadnezzar after a prolonged siege of 13 years. Now, in a similar scenario in Revelation 18 and verse 19, the great whore, who is Babylon, who sits on the waters and was made rich by all that had ships in the sea, will also lose her shipping trade. Now in chapter 29, there are also oracles against Israel's traditional enemy, Egypt, and its pharaoh, who is depicted in verse 3 of chapter 29 as a huge crocodile living in the Nile River. Like the king of Tyre, who boasts in chapter 28 and verse 2, I am God, in chapter 29 and verse 3, the Pharaoh of Egypt displays his ignorance by saying, the Nile is mine, and I made it. He too will be cut down by the Babylonians. The judgment of God against these rulers and nations are an example of the principle taught by Jesus in Luke 18:4, when he said, everyone who exalts himself will be humbled. And now we might consider section J on your outline. After Israel's traditional enemies are destroyed in the prophecies in chapters 25 to 32, the path is now clear for restoration. The restoration of the exiled people is then depicted in the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones in chapter 37 and verses 1 through 14. There, Ezekiel is transported in vision to a battlefield littered with the unburied skeleton of the fallen soldiers. Ezekiel asks, can these bones live? In answer, God tells him to proclaim to the bones that by the Spirit of God, they are to be raised to life again. The interpretation of this vision is given in verses 15 to 28 of chapter 37. The dead bones are the exiles. By his Spirit, God will renew the life of the people. He will raise them up from the Babylonian grave and restore them to their own land. As part of the interpretation of the restoration of the people, Ezekiel is called to take two sticks and to write on the one for Judah and to write on the other for Joseph. Joseph was the poetical name for the northern kingdom, Israel. He was then ordered to join the two sticks together in his hand so that they became one. This symbolized God's intention to reverse the division of Israel into two separate kingdoms that had happened shortly after Solomon's death, and to make them once again one people, as in the days of David. And we know who the king will be. He'll be the greater than David, the Messiah. Consider now, if you will, part K in your outline. In chapters 38 and 39, Ezekiel sees that the defeat and humiliation of Israel's traditional enemies close to home does not remove permanently and forever all threats to the life of restored Israel. Surely there will be other threats to the people of God. What about the barbarians who live on the edge of the world and who are yet unknown? The prophet foresees a time in the future when they will mobilize and come against Israel. The leader of these yet unknown hordes of the far north will be one called Gog from the land of Magog. When he and his allies come against Israel, they too will be destroyed, but not by any human agency, but by the direct intervention of God. In Ezekiel's prophecy, Gog and his hordes are a symbol of a yet unknown enemy, which represents the powers of evil in conflict with the kingdom of God, which will one day be permanently vanquished and destroyed. Part F on your outline. When the people return from Babylon, what would life be like in Israel? In the last nine chapters of the book, chapters 40 through 48, we have visions of the restored nation. At the heart of the new community is the vision of the new temple, Although Ezekiel's vision of the new temple has a lot of architectural references that make for interesting study, he's primarily concerned with the holiness of God and the life that is restored to the people as well as to the land. This vision, it came to a climax in chapter 47 with the account of the sacred stream. As soon as the temple is completed, a spring of water bubbles up from its threshold. This stream gets deeper and deeper as it flows eastward and further from the temple until it becomes a great river, healing and bringing life to the land with many trees springing up along its banks. When the water reaches the Dead Sea, which is so full of salt nothing can live in it or around it, the waters are healed, and life is brought to it, and it swarms with fish. The author of Revelation 21, in verse 1, says in the kingdom there was no more sea. That is, there is no more dead sea, no more dead water, no more trouble. Part M. And now we want to try to bring Ezekiel's message and vision concerning the destruction and restoration of whole nations into a more personal focus by looking at Ezekiel's message concerning individual responsibility. Now, prior to Jeremiah and Ezekiel, even though the idea of individual responsibility was present, it wasn't the dominant thought. It was more thought that God dealt with the family, or the clan, or the tribe, or the nation as a whole. All are bound together. When one sins, all are punished. The best example I can think of this is in the 7th chapter of Joshua. There, one man named Achan sinned by keeping some booty from the destruction of Jericho when all was supposed to be destroyed. But for this one man's sin, his whole family, wife, children, and animals, were all killed. And not only was the individual one with the group, there was also unity between one generation and the next. Exodus 20 and verse 5 states, God visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. The problem seems to be that following this principle, those who were taken captive to Babylon thought it was not necessarily anything that they did, but it was the generations before them that sinned and brought this calamity on their heads. As evidence of this, in Ezekiel 18:2, God says to Ezekiel that the people are quoting the proverb, the fathers have eaten the sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. To counteract this overstress that it is someone else's responsibility for our own problems, Ezekiel teaches that responsibility lies with each individual for his own life and conduct. God deals directly with each one and will not punish one man for the sins of the other. In 18:4, God says to Ezekiel, "Behold, all souls are mine. The soul of the father, as well as the soul of the son, is mine. The soul that sins shall die." In chapter 18, verses 5 through 18, a good father will be rewarded with his life, but there will be no benefit to his evil son. And on the other hand, if the father is evil and the son good, the son shall not die for the father's iniquity. He shall surely live. But we have to keep in mind, in correcting the old thought of overemphasizing corporate responsibility, Ezekiel here swings to the other extreme. He's not making a balanced argument. He's correcting a distortion. We know that all men do suffer because of Adamic sin, and we know that retributive justice is a part of God's plan. And we know that we do sometimes pay the penalty and suffer unjustly for what others have done. But Ezekiel teaches that these must never be made into an excuse for our sinning or our failure to shoulder the responsibility for our own character and conduct. Ezekiel himself is a good illustration of his own teaching. Ezekiel 3:17 says, "Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Whenever you hear a word from my mouth, you shall give them warning from me." If he fails to speak the warning, he will be held responsible for the death of the wicked. If he speaks the word faithfully, whether the word is received or rejected, his responsibility is discharged. So after reviewing the experiences and the prophecies of Ezekiel, we see that his message had two parts. The first part was to warn of the impending doom to the natural house of Israel, and the second part was their restoration after the destruction. The warnings of Ezekiel are also representative of the two-part message of the church class. The first part is to nominal spiritual Israel regarding Christendom's impending doom. The second part is to any with an ear to hear that after the destruction of the old order, the blessed kingdom will be ushered in, and all will be restored. Since all Christians are called to bear witness in giving this two-part message, we should all take this challenge to heart and follow Ezekiel's good example. May the Lord add.